From the City of Angels off the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be, across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Quite a show and tap for you today. Next hour, Stephen Quayle, Shane Connor, our guests. The reality of nuclear terror. We need to talk about that tonight. In Phoenix, boy, the weather is getting very, very nasty there. A record heat wave has led now to the deaths of 18 people, most of them homeless, leaving officials scrambling to provide water and shelter to the city's transient population. For the first time in years, homeless shelters open their doors during the day to offer assistance from the blistering sun, which has delivered above average temperatures every day since June 29th. Police even began passing out thousands of water bottles donated by grocery stores, city officials setting up tents for shade downtown. They don't know why, but it continues to just get very, very hot in that area. In Riyadh, Saudi Arabia, as Interior Ministry officials announced the discovery of a suspected terrorist hideout containing large quantities of chemicals used to make explosives, a warning has been issued for Americans in Saudi Arabia that a series of terrorist attacks may be in the pipeline. The information originated from the American National Counterterrorism Center. It's the new hub for threat information here in the United States. Officials say that they uncovered a reported militant lair near Riyadh in which they found bomb-making materials, including fertilizer, ammonium nitrate, and other chemicals. The threat information was vague, with no indication of when, where, and how attacks would be carried out, but was considered credible enough to issue a warning. In Washington, D.C., subway riders may face random police checks of their bags under a security measure being considered in the nation's capital, the largest city to look for ways to deter terrorism on rail systems. No decision has been made on the idea for the city's 106-mile metro rail system, and the logistics would be difficult, but it would be another tool in our security toolbox, says the Washington Metropolitan Area Transit. The possibility is one of many ideas being floated elsewhere and here while the terrorist threat level for transit systems remains at high after the July 7th terrorist suicide bombings in London's underground rail tunnels. A defector claims to have been in the North Korean parliament says that that communist state has produced a nuclear bomb and attempted to sell missiles to Taiwan. South Korean intelligence authorities declined to comment on the report, which said that the defector, a man believed to be in his 70s, using the alias of Kim Il-du, defected to the South in May. He says that North Korea has built a one-ton nuclear bomb by using 4 kilograms of plutonium. The North is now seeking to miniaturize the bomb, he says, to make it more reliable as a weapon. Near White Plains, New York, sirens meant to warn thousands of people of an emergency at a nuclear plant complex north of New York City stood useless for nearly 6 hours Tuesday when power was lost to a signal transmitter and the failure just went undiscovered. There was no emergency and the 156 sirens were not needed during the outage, but the bottom line is they say it's inexcusable, so they're going to find out what went wrong. In the former Soviet Georgia, police detained a man suspected of throwing a live grenade during a rally at which President Bush spoke in May. The capture came after a shootout in which one officer was killed and another wounded. Local television showed pictures of a dark-haired man it described as the suspect being hustled into a car by police officers. He was wounded, apparently, and in his late 20s. Scientists are gaining insight about December's devastating earthquake and tsunami from the actual sounds of the magnitude 9.3 quake in the Indian Ocean. It's really quite eerie, they say, quite a sound to hear the earth ripping apart. We hear it on smaller earthquakes quite frequently, but something of this scale that goes on for 8 minutes is very much unprecedented. The microphones that picked up this earthquake were located in Diego Garcia, an island more than 1,700 miles from the epicenter of the quake. I want you to hear a little bit of this dramatic soundtrack. That That is the soundtrack of the rupture of the Sumatra Fault. And that is what it sounds like. Those microphones that capture the sound are part of a global network of instruments that monitor compliance with the Comprehensive Nuclear Test Ban Treaty. If you go to the coasttocoastam.com website, take a quick look at the hot stories. Massive shark caught off the vineyards. A thousand pound tiger shark. This thing is huge. A picture is worth a thousand words. The toothy shark was almost brought into a competition, but the boat was 6 minutes late, so they couldn't qualify. It would have won. I mean, a massive size shark. NASA said, by the way, it has now set a new tentative launch date for the shuttle Discovery. They're going to try for July 26. NASA scrubbed the planned liftoff on July 13th after a glitch occurred in one of Discovery's fuel gauge systems during launch preparations. The planned July 26 launch would be the first U.S. shuttle launch since Columbia tore apart February of 2003, killing all seven astronauts aboard. Now, where were you 36 years ago? Apollo 11, the crew, Neil Armstrong, Edward Buzz Aldrin, they went to the moon, Michael Collins. He stayed above. This is what it sounded like.
Contact light. Okay, engine stop. APA at a descent. Host control, both auto, descent engine command override off. Engine arm off. 113 is in.
We copy you down, Eagle.
Listen, Tranquility Base here. The Eagle has landed.
Roger, Tranquility. We copy you on the ground. You got a bunch of guys about to turn blue. We're breathing again. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
You're looking good here.
Okay, we're going to be busy for a minute.
You imagine that? 36 years ago. I remember where I was, just a kid. Just 19 years old, just watching television downstairs with my parents, and I just couldn't believe it. My eyes were just glued to the television. Actor James Doohan, who played the chief, you know, this is a story that that touches all of us. If you're a Star Trek fan or if you just enjoy science fiction, Scotty, Montgomery Scott, died now at the age of 85 years old. Doohan, whose role was immortalized in the line, "Beam me up," and they say Scotty, but I think it was more "Beam me up, Mr. Scott," had been suffering from pneumonia and Alzheimer's disease. His wife of 28 years, Wendy, was by his side. Doohan was a popular character actor when he auditioned for the part in 1966. When the series ended in 1969, he found himself typecast in the role. The Canadian-born actor was a master of dialect, developing during his years on radio. When asked what accent he thought his Star Trek character should have, he said, "I believe the Scott voice was the most commanding."
"I can't give you what nine much longer, Mr. Spock. These engines are beginning to show signs of stress. If we keep this speed, we'll blow up any minute now.
If I push these impulse engines too hard in the condition they're in, they'll blow apart."
Doohan's character, Scotty, manned the Star Trek Enterprise with Captain James T. Kirk, played by William Shatner, and Mr. Spock, of course, played by Leonard Nimoy. We contacted the offices of Captain Kirk, William Shatner, today, and he gave us this statement. "A long and storied career is over. I knew Jim when he started out in Canada, and I knew him in his last years in America. So we go way back. My condolences go out to the family." That's from William Shatner. Somebody else whose life was touched by Star Trek, by Scotty, Richard C. Hoagland, who has now turned his entire website and his ability to search for the unknown. It's called theenterprisemission.com. Richard C. Hoagland, he must have touched you in some way for you to pick up the Enterprise Mission as really your focal point in all the work you do.
You know, George, it's really eerie tonight that we're celebrating these two diametrically opposed events. 36 years ago, I remember vividly where I was because I was covering the landing on the moon of Neil and Buzz for Cronkite and CBS. I was in a huge hangar in Southern California looking out the huge hangar doors with Robert Heinlein, who was the dean of American science fiction. And he was looking at me and looking at the moon. We were both looking at a TV set. And on the TV, you could see Neil and Buzz in those ghostly images literally coming a quarter million miles back from the moon that we could see looking out the hangar door. It was eerie. And to have Scotty, to have Jimmy Doohan die today on the 36th anniversary of those footprints on the moon almost makes an eerie perfect circle, because it was just about a year ago that Neil Armstrong, in a tribute to James Doohan and his character as Scotty on Star Trek, said the following. He said, "I commanded three different types of spacecraft flying as fast as 25,000 miles an hour. None of them had warp drive, but the Enterprise was 100,000 times faster than anything I ever flew. Our craft did not have the ability to leave the solar system. It did not have a transporter to descend onto a planet. It would have been far more effective and less traumatic if we could have beamed down. When I get command," he said, "of a starship, I want a chief engineering officer like Montgomery Scott." And that, to me, George, sums up where we are tonight, because for generations, Star Trek, and actually more than any other individual, I think more than Bill Shatner, more than Nimoy, more than, you know, Bones, James Doohan, personified the Enterprise, the ship that took us where no one had gone before. And frankly, I will miss him.
And he kept it all together, and now apparently, Richard, he would like his ashes scattered in space. Isn't that something?
I think that would be a perfect fitting, you know, completion of that circle. And I find it incredibly ironic tonight that just before we, you know, came on the air, NASA announced they finally found the problem with Discovery, and the shuttle's going to launch next Tuesday. Uh-huh. Well, if Scotty had been on the job, they would have found it a long time ago.
And it had already been in space. In space. Richard, we're going to talk with you Friday. You've got some updates for us on Deep Impact, so we will see you then, my friend.
Thanks, George. And to everyone out there, please, you know, think of Scott's family. And Jim, we are with you.
Richard C. Hoagland, EnterpriseMission.com. In a moment, an expert on Star Trek, Richard Arnold on Coast to Coast AM. Now, wait till you hear this one. Born in Vancouver, Canada, Richard Arnold was already a fan of science fiction when Star Trek began airing in 1966. He attended his first convention, the 1969 Worldcon. This summer, his family moved to St. Louis, Missouri, my old hometown. There, he ran Star Trek fan clubs in both his high school and college and attended some 20 conventions in the United States and Canada. Among those was the first all-Star Trek convention held in New York City. That was in January of 1972. And it was at that convention that he first met Star Trek's creator, Gene Roddenberry, a man who would later greatly influence his life. In 1974, Richard moved to Los Angeles, California, where he got to know Susan Sackett, Gene Roddenberry's newly hired assistant and a fellow Star Trek fan. Due to his good working knowledge of the Star Trek universe, he soon found himself involved as a volunteer consultant to Roddenberry's office. And in 1986, after nearly 10 years of being Paramount's resident Trekkie, he was hired by the studio at Roddenberry's insistence and became the studio's official Star Trek consultant. This was in time to work on the show's 20th anniversary, the promotion of Star Trek IV, The Voyage Home, and the early development of Star Trek The Next Generation. He also began attending some 20 to 25 conventions a year, becoming in the minds of many an ambassador for Star Trek. Richard remained in this position until shortly after Roddenberry's death, and Richard now deals in Star Trek trading cards, a sideline that grew out of writing copy for manufacturers and helping them design new sets. He's our honored guest this hour on Coast to Coast. Richard, thank you for joining us today. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Tell me a little bit about James Doohan. Not the one that we saw on television, the Scotty, but the real person. What was he like behind the scenes?
Jimmy had a love for life and for everything that comes with that. Enjoyed the convention scene because, you know, he certainly enjoyed the fans coming up to him and telling him what a tremendous effect that he had had on their lives. He constantly heard from people that they had gone into engineering because of his character on Star Trek. In fact, he got an honorary degree in engineering at the Milwaukee School of Engineering when half the students that were polled there said that they went into engineering because of his role on Star Trek.
I used to try to imitate him in school all the time. I would do my, "Captain, I'm giving it all she's got." And I just loved it. I could not get enough of that program. He was one of my favorite characters, the way he portrayed himself, the way he carried himself. Didn't he lose a middle finger in battle?
That was during the Second World War. I think he was with the Royal Canadian Artillery. In fact, I think he wore his patch on his jacket at the 25th anniversary event at the Smithsonian when everybody was in suit and tie, and he was wearing his Canadian Royal Artillery badge. Still very proud of that. I think that was on D-Day. He lost that finger and took several other bullets.
There was something very mystical about this program and about this original group, the way they seemed, at least during the television shows, to band together. There was a camaraderie there, and you don't find that a lot. And I could feel it. I could feel it as a kid watching this program, and I'm sure a lot of other people could too, Richard.
Well, I think it was the first science fiction series with a continuing cast that didn't every week have a completely different cast. And they were cast personally by Gene, who used to say that if he had any strength at all, it was in casting. And they really did, you know, work extremely well together as a group. And despite, you know, the people looking back and saying, you know, oh, what a terrible experience it was, at the time, they all worked together very well, and you can see that in the blooper reels. If you watch those from the original series, they obviously were having a good time.
And they all fit their parts so well.
Oh, yeah, yeah. If you look at Star Trek The Next Generation, Gene did the same thing there. He very, very carefully cast all of those characters, and they became a family as well.
His death today also really points out again the frailty of all of us and how age catches all of us. You know, I was 16 years old when this all started, and I'm not 16 anymore, Richard. It goes by fast, doesn't it?
None of us are now.
And, you know, I still see Shatner on some of these television commercials, and we'll probably get him on the program in the not-too-distant future just to talk about Star Trek. But it does go by so fast.
Oh, yeah. You know, Jimmy was one of the very first to start doing the conventions back in the early 70s, and I believe I met him at the second New York Star Trek convention in 1973. I don't think he was at the first one. And that began this friendship that, you know, went on for 30 years. The last time I saw him was when he got his star on Hollywood Boulevard just a little under a year ago. And it was, you know, it was hard because he was very frail. He was in a wheelchair. He was having difficulty with his speech. And he obviously wasn't, you know, remembering everybody. I was, you know, unsure as to whether he had remembered me. We'd had dinner in Seattle a year before that. And at one point he was sort of looking at me as though he didn't know who I was, and later came over almost in tears and apologized for, you know, not remembering my name, which, you know, was difficult. But I'd been through that with my own grandfather. And, you know, it's hard to see your hero's age.
You know, it really is. When I saw the story today and said, my gosh, he's 85 years old. We still remember them because we see them in all these reruns and these older programs and on DVDs now. Right. And they don't age. I mean, they go on forever. And when you think of them as 85 years old, it's kind of shocking for a while.
Well, that's almost the age my grandfather was, and I, you know, certainly thought of him as being quite elderly when he passed. But Jimmy was so full of life, it was so difficult to see him, you know, at the end there as he was getting thinner and was losing his energy. He was the one who really kept the fans going at the conventions and would sit and sign autographs for free for hours on end. And, you know, would have to go up and change his shirt and come back down and keep going. And he, you know, he certainly enjoyed his drink. That was certainly no secret. And he could, you know, easily get through a fifth, or actually it was a pint, at most signings, although I think he might have started on a second at some of them. A friend of mine, Scott Evans, and I went up to his place up in the valley when he was living up in, I think it was North Hollywood.
Yeah.
We went up there to get him, I think, to sign some things. It was about 10 o'clock in the morning, and he was sitting in a trailer in the driveway, and he wasn't in the house. They were having some work done in the house. And he invited us into the trailer, and we sat down, and he offered us some whiskey. And we said,
a little early.
Can you like mix some Coke with it? And he said, what, and ruin it?
I love it. Hey, Richard, stay with us. Can you take some phone calls from listeners about Star Trek? We'll do that. Phone numbers, west of the Rockies, 800-618-8255. East of the Rockies, 800-825-5033. First-time caller line, 818-501-4721. And the wild card line is open for you, 818-501-4109. I'm George Norrie, our guest this hour, Richard Arnold. Your questions about Star Trek when we come right back. Well, we received an email from one of our great coast-to-coast listeners, probably you, just thanking us for making the CD available called Perfect Possession with the After Dark subscription. First of all, our thanks, of course, to Art Bell for the phenomenal interview that he had conducted years ago with the late Father Malachi Martin to make all of this possible for you. You're getting this CD free, small shipping and handling, when you order the After Dark newsletter. Call this number, 1-888-727-5505. That's 1-888-727-5505. Or you can also go online, safe and secure, right down at the bottom of the homepage. You'll see the link, coast2coastam.com. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie with our guest, Richard Arnold, and your phone calls. Richard, they still love the baseball Cardinals in St. Louis, by the way.
Where in St. Louis are you from?
Right there. I wasn't born there. I was born in Detroit, but I moved to St. Louis in 79.
I lived in Webster Grove.
Great city.
A little bit to the south there.
So what was the more accurate statement? Was it beam me up, Scotty, or beam me up, Mr. Scott?
No one ever said either. In the history of the show, which, believe me, I ran into all the time when I was working.
Where did it come from?
The fans made it up. In the early 70s, it just became sort of a catchphrase. It's like, play it again, Sam.
I love it.
Yeah, I've run into it a lot of times, and people have said, oh, come on, and you know, I'm sure people have watched all 79 episodes to try and prove me wrong, but he never had anyone say that to him.
I wonder how many people would know that.
Well, I'm trying to educate people.
Well, right now, about 5 to 10 million.
Good.
To the phones we go, west of the Rockies, you're on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hello, George. How are you tonight?
I'm fine tonight. Thank you.
I wanted to say hi to Richard, old friend.
Who's this?
Bill Blake.
Bill, good God, where are you?
I'm in Palmdale right now.
Hot?
Yeah, very hot, over 100 plus.
Oh, yep. My God.
I wanted to say hi and wanted to say that it's unfortunate with Jimmy's passing, but somehow the man always brought people together, and I think he kind of brought us back together again tonight.
Yeah, I mean, it's been a long time, Bill.
I got through so easy.
Wow.
Yeah.
You remember the early days, you and me and Paula and all the other guys at the house and going over to Jimmy's, which was almost around the corner from there.
That's right.
Yeah.
George, just so you know part of this history.
Yeah.
Richard stayed at my apartment one night to make me feel a little bit less nervous about my first part in Hollywood on the Planet of the Apes television series.
I love it.
A long time.
Now, what part did you play?
Well, it was a small role. It was just a chimpanzee farmer, but it launched me off onto a big promotional tour for 20th Century Fox, and I did that for years, doubling for Roddy McDowell's character on the road.
Oh, that's fantastic.
And this was like 30 years ago.
And the strange thing is, this all had association with Jimmy and Gene Roddenberry. Jimmy and Wendy took a liking to me and Paula. We used to hang out at conventions together. And Gene Roddenberry was actually instrumental in getting me on the Apes television series, because people don't know this, but Gene was actually in the background of the Planet of the Apes television series.
I didn't know that at all.
Yes. In fact, if it had been renewed after January, there's a good chance he would have been helping the producers and helping write some of the scenarios, because they were kind of depending on him off the strength of his experience with Star Trek.
What a genius he was. Hey, Bill, thanks for the call.
Thank you.
Appreciate that. Small world, isn't
it,
Richard?
Yeah.
Next up, let's go to our wild card line. You're on Coast to Coast. Where are you calling from?
Hi, this is Deanna calling from Memphis.
Hi, Deanna. Go ahead.
Just wanted to say I'm a super big fan of Coast to Coast and also a huge Star Trek fan, and so saddened to hear of Mr. Doohan's death. But I mainly wanted to to find out what Richard's thoughts were on the end of the Star Trek series and what he might know about where, you know, the future goes for the series.
What do you think, Rich? By the way, I went out there maybe 2 or 3 weeks before they filmed the last program. I met Scott Bakula, and we had Jolene Blaylock on the program. But what happens? Is it over now? Everything done, or might there be some kind of resurrection?
It's all pretty much finished. Shortly after you were there and they finished the final episode, they pulled all the sets down literally as they were finishing filming on them. And the sound stages were completely cleared. And the last time that I went over there, they were just empty sound stages with fresh gray paint on the floor, which was kind of odd because Stage 9 had had Star Trek sets on it since 1977. 28 years.
It was amazing how they filmed and videoed those episodes because, of course, when we watch it at home or on the big screen, you don't realize what they're doing. And then you go and see it and you go, that's incredible.
Yeah. Now, right now, it's taking a rest, and I think it really needs a rest. I think a lot of the fans would agree with that, that, you know, there's people that have been working 18 years nonstop, some of them three series, and, you know, a lot of the creative juices have kind of stopped flowing. They need a chance to re-energize.
Yeah, so. That's true, and a lot of them want to do something else now, too.
Yeah.
East of the Rockies.
It may be a while.
All right, you're on the air, East of the Rockies. Hi there.
Hi, George. This is Royce from Harrisburg. How you doing?
Hi, Royce. Fine, thank you.
I just wanted to call in, and I agree with Richard. It is very sad with the passing of Jimmy Doohan. I had the chance to meet him twice in Valley Forge, and the man was so sharp that he remembered my name, and I was just one of many people walking through an autograph line. I know a lot of my friends are huge Star Trek fans, and we're going to miss him quite a bit.
One of the wonders of DVD now and tape, he'll in our hearts at least, he'll live on forever.
That's true. Right. Very much.
Thank you, Royce. Appreciate it. What was it, Richard, about Roddenberry's genius that gave him that ability to look into the future? Because I do believe a lot of the things that we saw on Star Trek can and will happen.
Can I read you an email?
Absolutely.
That I got? Because it kind of speaks to that. And I've been inundated today with phone calls and emails. Most of them ask me to pass condolences on to Jimmy's family. This one's from a friend of mine who lives in, I believe he's still in Georgia.
Okay.
I had the privilege to meet Jimmy several times, or actually Alabama. In fact, he was the only person at the very first convention I ever went to in Birmingham, Alabama, when I was just 11. I know I'm only one person in the millions of lives he touched, but I just wanted to share with you how that first encounter proved to me that the ideals and aspirations of Star Trek and Gene Roddenberry were not just television stories, but could be a reality if we all tried a little harder. If you get a chance, please tell Jimmy's family that millions of people's lives were enriched because of his generosity, his abilities, and his love and belief in what Gene was trying to say.
Right on the money.
And that's from Devin Laney.
Right on the money.
Yeah, you know, Gene used to say if he knew what it was that brought, you know, the audience to Star Trek, and at first, you know, the studio didn't believe that they were actually out there. But when they discovered, I think in 1970, the year after Star Trek was canceled, when they first started testing the new rating systems, that Star Trek had actually been one of their most popular shows, and they'd canceled it, but it was too late at that point. When this began to become a phenomenon, which, you know, it was just a television series, but when it became a phenomenon, he said if he understood what it was that had made it that he would have done nothing but create Star Trek his entire career. But he never really understood either. The studio never understood. The network never understood. You know, Gene was simply speaking to whatever it was in the audience at the time, talking about a future where we survived through the Cold War, through Vietnam, through everything else, with dignity as a unified planet, and we're out there exploring, not conquering. And I think a lot of that actually is pretty relevant today.
You know, I've never been a supporter, Richard, of a one-world government. However, when you look at the Star Trek shows and you see the Federation together,
right,
it's the only thing that gives me any comfort in the event we go down that way with this planet one day.
Right.
I look at that and I see how they all intermingle and how they work, and I say, well, you know what? Maybe, because it seemed to have functioned, at least on television, better than the United Nations does today.
Well, it was the way Gene lived his life as well. And, you know, it was a future that he really believed would work. A lot of people referred to it as Pollyannish, but, you know, hey, I'd rather have that than Star Wars for the future.
Absolutely. First-time caller line, where are you calling from?
Angelo, Texas.
Okay, welcome to the show.
I'm a first-time caller, long-time listener.
Thank you.
The first time I actually got in. And I have two questions. One, how did Jimmy feel about Geordi taking over the reins as far as the new series?
Actually, all of the actors from the original series were a little bit peeved when, you know, the next generation was being created, because as far as they were concerned, if they weren't in it, it shouldn't be called Star Trek. And Gene not only had to deal with them, he had to deal with fans for the first, you know, more than a year, almost a year and a half, saying, you know, it's not Star Trek if it doesn't have Kirk, Spock, McCoy, etc. It took a while. I think the first one who really began to support it was Nichelle Nichols, and I think Jimmy joined fairly shortly after that, saying, look, just because it's not us doesn't mean it's not Star Trek. It's Gene Roddenberry. It's the Federation. It's the same basic concept. You know, it's, you know, we're still making the movies. It's not like we're no longer in the picture.
What happened with Riker? I understood he was in the producing movies and whatnot, and in charge of some of the movies as far as directing.
Well, he directed a couple of the films, and he was over in England for a long time. He directed a film over there called Thunderbirds, which I think came out not too long ago. And right now he's down in South Africa working on a film down there. And, in fact, I had an email from somebody working with him in South Africa just saying that they had just found out that Jimmy had passed, and they were giving me their condolences.
So there is no future with possibly him and in the future producing some more movies?
Not at the moment. I'll give you a quote from a former very, very senior person over at Paramount who said that, you know, sure, there'll be another Star Trek movie, but not until, you know, 10 years from now, 35 years from now. You know, not immediately. The last movie lost them about $50 million.
Oh, my. So they didn't make money.
Well, that wasn't the fault of the writer or the, you know, the actors. They released that movie 5 days before the second Lord of the Rings film, The Two Towers. And believe me, their box office dropped 96% after 5 days.
Oh, thanks for the call, John. Appreciate you being on the program. Were they friends off the set, Richard, as well as they appeared to be on the set, or did they just go their separate ways?
The original series cast?
Yeah.
Oh, absolutely. But it was sort of two groups, the Triumvirate, Bill Leonard and D. Kelly, and the Gang of Four, as they called themselves, Jimmy, George, Walter, and Nichelle. And, you know, they would see each other at conventions. You know, the seven of them occasionally would get together as a group or at functions at the studio or things like the 25th anniversary at the Smithsonian. But generally, the four co-stars would be the ones who tended to find themselves together more often. And that would happen in their personal lives as well. And Bill and Leonard, you know, were great friends after the series. And Dee was always extremely private and pretty much stayed to his house in Sherman Oaks with his wife, Carolyn. And the two of them rarely socialized with anybody.
I ran into Walter maybe about a year ago at a restaurant.
Mm-hmm.
And he hasn't aged at all.
No. He stays out of the sun. He thinks that that's probably a good idea.
Yeah.
And he still runs. You know, he's in very good shape ever since his heart attack. He's made a point of staying in shape.
Wildcard Line, welcome to the program. You're on the air. Hi there.
Hi, George. Hi, Richard. I just wanted to share a little story with you. My wife and I got to go to a book signing when he released his first engineering novel of space and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
I think that was back, what, 90 or 91? And we were standing in line, and he asked us to come forward. And he signed the book for us, and he asked for us to sit on his lap. And I thought he wanted me to sit on his lap. And I sit on his lap. And he goes, no, not you, son. Her lap. I want her to sit on my lap. My wife sat down on his lap, and my wife blushed, and he gave her a little kiss on the cheek, and that's a special moment in our life, and he's a really neat guy.
Oh, yeah.
And we had a Polaroid shot taken where he was charging $5 for a Polaroid shot. She took the picture to work and showed the picture to her friends, and her friend said, who's that guy behind her? That was me laughing, and they thought I was David Letterman, had no clue it was James Doohan sitting there with her.
Wow. And at least he didn't say any joke about warp drive or anything like that.
Well, I did say one comment that says, beam me up has a home and meaning. But,
right, thanks for the call.
You
Well, you know that Jimmy and Wendy have a five-year-old daughter. She's just five now. He was 80 when she was born, and if that said anything, it was that all his thrusters were still firing.
My. That's something.
Yeah.
East of the Rockies, you're up on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Yeah, hi. How are you guys doing?
I'm fine. Where might you be, by the way?
This is Andy in Dallas.
Go ahead, Andy.
I just wanted to share another James Doohan anecdote. My mother pretty much raised us on Star Trek, and she wrote him a letter back in the 70s and told him if he was ever in the area that she'd make him a home-cooked meal. And he was generous enough to write a letter back to her and tell her about the spaghetti sauce he was making, and she still has that to this day.
That's great. See, it's that kind of character, I think, that is so important for America today. And I bet they were all this way. You know, I used to see Shatner in St. Louis. He would be an honorary spokesperson for Diabetes Foundation. And he was always there at these events. You know, they gave back. They didn't just take, Richard.
Yeah. Oh, well, he does his Hollywood charity horse show every year.
Yeah.
And he just had this this last one that was the end of April or beginning of May. I think he raised almost $300,000 for children's charities at that event. He puts an enormous amount of work into it.
Let's go to our first time caller line. You're on the air. And where are you?
Sugarloaf, New York.
Oh, hi there.
Hi. George, I was interested in what you said about One World. I agree with what you said about the One World appeal of Star Trek, and I really loved it as a teen. But, you reminded me about what's going on in the world today. And I love Scotty. And I know this is kind of off the subject, but I'm wondering if you feel that nowadays Star Trek may become obsolete by the, somewhat Islamo or Islamic fascism or that's going on now?
No, I don't. But I guess what would taint, I think, the thought of a perfect world government would be, of course, the Illuminati, a little bit out of what we're talking about with you tonight, Richard. It would be great if it could be what that federation was in Star Trek.
Well, we're certainly nowhere there yet. Gene used to say we're better today than we were 400 years ago, and 400 years from now we'll be better than we are today. But he said we're barely one step out of the cave, throwing rocks at the moon and hating people because they live on the other side of the hill and are different than us. And he said until we learn to get over those fears of difference and celebrate difference, we've got no business going out into space.
Did Gene ever share with you why he created Star Trek in the first place?
Yeah, actually, it was a way to tell stories about what he referred to as the human condition without having to kill people, because he had done nothing but westerns and cop shows where the idea of every episode was to establish the bad guy and kill him at the end of the episode. And he got really tired of writing that, and he wanted to write more upbeat stuff. And this way, you know, with Star Trek being science fiction, he could write about, you know, insane politics and religion and equality of the sexes and the races and get it over the network's censors' heads, because it was about purple people on polka dot planets and they wouldn't get it.
You know, they have a little doll figurine of Scotty. And,
loads of them.
They're out there. I think I might pick one of them up and just keep it.
There you go. Keep it in the plastic container, though.
Absolutely. Richard, yeah. So what are you doing now?
Well, I'm working on a new project starting, I think, tomorrow at Paramount, but I can't discuss that yet. And still working at the conventions, speaking about Star Trek, still doing about 30 of those a year. Working with the cards, which is definitely a fun hobby, and helping with the design of those and selling them, which is a very lucrative hobby, which keeps me off the street and keeps me from having to get a real job. Just came back from a Star Trek cruise through the Baltic, from Copenhagen to Tallinn, Helsinki, Stockholm, St. Petersburg. And we've got a huge convention coming up in Las Vegas in the middle of August. It's going to be pretty hot there, but
oh my gosh,
they've already sold over 10,000 tickets for the weekend. And it's got, you know, four of the five captains, so it should be a pretty great weekend.
That's great. Yeah. We had on the program about a year ago Natalia Nogulich.
Yeah.
Wonderful person.
Yeah.
Wonderful.
She's going to be there.
Richard, thank you so much. Let's stay in touch, okay?
Okay.
Richard
Arnold. Keep me in your Rolodex.
Expert Star Trek. And this, of course, was our tribute to James Doohan. Scotty, beam me up. I guess it didn't ever happen.